This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Filmmaker M. Night Shyamalan has entertained audiences for over two decades with movies like The Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, and Signs. As founder of the M. Night Shyamalan Foundation, he has led initiatives to feed the hungry, empower women, and provide children in Africa with life-saving vitamins. Now he's tackling one of the most hotly debated topics here in the U.S., schools.
There's no evidence that shows that a school that's funded on one side of the street for $17,000 per pupil outperforms the one across the street that's funded at $11,000 per pupil.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, a conversation with this award-winning director about how he got schooled about the keys to education reform. We'll also spend an academic minute looking at the history of water. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In 2008, Oscar-nominated film director M. Night Shyamalan decided to take an active role in helping fix what's wrong in American public education. He learned that there are five keys to closing America's achievement gap. But just as we must do several things to maintain good health, eat the right foods, exercise regularly, get a good night's sleep, so too must we use all five keys to turn around our lowest performing schools. These five keys are used by all the schools that are succeeding, and no schools are succeeding without them. He talks about those five keys in his new book, I Got Schooled, the unlikely story of how a moonlighting movie maker learned the five keys to closing America's education gap. The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue spoke to M. Night Shyamalan about those five keys and why he took on this project in the first place.
You know what's funny about this whole subject, and when I talk about it, I am the first person that when you see a celebrity kind of good saying something for a cause, I'm the first person that cringes. I'm the guy who goes, ooh, they should just act. Why are they even talking? So this is really not that. Ironically, it might seem like that, but it's not. Really what it was a search to understand the research and approach it really as a kind of a learning expedition of what others know and putting it together to, you know, in one place. But it really started from a location scout on a film that I was looking for a high school to shoot in Philadelphia. And we went and saw this beautiful high school. We got out of the van and all the crew went in, and I went into this high school and the kids all started going crazy. Oh, you're here, you're making a movie, oh my God. Can I be in it? Oh, can I die in the movie? And it was the funnest time we had with these kids, and the teachers all came out. We had a wonderful visit seeing all the classrooms and hallways and all that stuff. Then we got back in the van and we drove for, you know, not long, dude, maybe 5 minutes, you know, in Philadelphia to another high school. And now this high school was the complete opposite. We get there and we have to wait in this kind of drab hallway outside the metal detectors for the guard who comes out of the booth, who kind of checks everything, and then he scans you through the metal detector to make sure you don't have any guns or knives and that kind of thing. You go into this hallway that's so dimly lit, and the kids are moving very slowly. No one's making eye contact. No one cares that we're there. No one even looks. And, you know, to go look at the classrooms, they had to unlock the bars. There are bars over every classroom door, and they have to, you know, find the keys to unlock them, and it was a prison. So by the time I left this school, I was really feeling upset, and, you know, in a way that everybody should feel. You know, you felt touched by a situation, and I just wanted to understand what the differences were. What was going on in one school? What were they doing? What was going on in this school? Can someone tell me? And that began a kind of a process of me asking questions to people, saying, hey, can you tell me what works to close the achievement gap? Why is there an achievement gap between inner city, you know, African-American and Hispanic kids and their white suburban counterparts? Why does that exist? And what has been found to close that gap? And then I got all these different answers from all the different people working in the field, none of them really jiving with each other. So then that made me come to the decision of spending, I didn't realize it at the time, but 4.5 years going around the country and researching all the existing research on education reform to see what has been proven to work and what hasn't been proven.
One of the things that's fascinating about the book and one of the points that you make is that money is not the answer to these problems.
Yeah, you know what's fascinating? I think what happens when you don't know the actual details of everything, generalizations happen, and it's in those generalizations that, you know, falsehoods can arise. And in one, for example, that more money is actually the problem, when in reality, there's no evidence, research, that shows that a school that's funded on one side of the street for 17,000 per pupil outperforms the one across the street that's funded at 11,000 per pupil. There's no evidence of that. In fact, there's plenty of evidence to say that there's no difference. And what you end up finding is there is a minimum number that is needed for educating these kids, and we need to make sure that all of them have that number. From then on, it's where you put the money that has any effect at all. Things that astonished me when I looked at the research was like the fact that paying for teachers' higher education degrees, master's programs, PhD programs, has zero effect on student achievement, zero. That shocked me because our household is completely about higher education, and that was surprising. But that's about $60 billion, I think, in the United States that we're spending on something that has zero effect on kids. And you keep tallying up those numbers, you know, administrative costs, facilities. Now, we're talking about closing the achievement gap, not about what, you know, how to make those suburban schools, the white suburban schools, even better. That's another book. I'm just talking about giving all the kids the same opportunity in this country.
You started this by looking at just two schools in one large city on the East Coast. What is fascinating is how you started to fill in some of the blanks as you went across the country.
Yeah.
And it's safe to say that the problems are very similar. They're different, and everybody is unique, and they have their own set of issues. But when you get down to it, there's still these incredible disparities between this part of the town and that part of town.
Yeah, you know what was really disheartening and heartening at the same time was early on in the process when I said, okay, let's just go to the city where they're doing it correctly, and let's go observe everything they're doing. Let's go to the school system where they're doing it right, where they don't have the gap, and let's study it. So let's fly there. And then we looked and looked and looked, and there wasn't any. And what was incredible was the uniformity of the disparity. The heartening part was suddenly realizing that the entire country is working as one system, and it's very consistent. So this was good news, because now I go, it's not random. It's working as a system. So now this is my parents being doctors. This is kind of the training in my head, is that, okay, this is the system, so how does the system work? We haven't figured out how the system works. We know it's a system. So let's look at the research, and maybe there's an answer there of how to tip the balance back to a different equilibrium.
You talk a lot about, in the book, the teachers, the quality of the teachers, and what ultimately is possible when you get the right teacher in the right environment.
What ultimately will close the achievement gap, the buzzword always in this world, is scalability. It's got to be something that can work for almost everybody, right? It can't just be just the Michael Jordans. It works for the Michael Jordans, and that's enough. It's got to be working for the great majority, 95, 97% of the people that are teaching and are in these schools have to succeed in closing the gap. Okay, there's a whole set of things that need to occur around these teachers for that to happen. As you get like more and more skilled teachers, like the top 25 teachers, here's the amazing thing about all of this. If in some magic world, the entire country could be taught by the top 20% of teachers, those teachers could close the gap within 4 years themselves. Just by themselves, they could close the gap. Now, that's not physically possible for the entire country to be taught by 20% of the teachers. And what happens is when you get the bottom tier group, they start dragging and pulling down, and you start losing time with the kids, and so they have to constantly make that up. The things that have been found in the research that I show in the book make it possible for, let's say, most of the teachers in the bottom 20% to succeed at closing the gap.
You write in the book, it's one of my favorite passages. One bit of advice I'm ready to share is this. Whenever anyone brings up Finland, back away slowly.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny because there's so many things that people get stuck on in this. It's such a heated topic, by the way, and I understand why it's so heated. And in a way, because I'm not involved in the field, it's been easier for me to have conversations with people on either side of a position, because I'm not invested. I didn't spend my life on one side of the fence or the other. But a lot of topics come up that become like sticking points, and one of them has been like Finland, because Finland is, you know, their education system, they score the highest on the international tests and all that stuff. But what we're talking about here, what really is at the core of this education gap between inner city kids, inner city African American and Hispanic kids, and their white suburban counterparts is literally the fact that this country was built on a sin. It was built on slavery, and we are still dealing with that chasm today. Those inclinations, those belief systems on all sides. And so when those kids walk out of that school, they're getting bombarded from the neighborhood, from everyone around them, the messages in the air saying you're not as good. There's not a place for you. Those messages are there and they're huge. And Finland doesn't have that. Finland doesn't have this kind of racial inequality thing. They weren't built on slavery. They don't have it. They have other issues, but they're not our issues. And so there's nothing to mimic there. And Finland is like, it's so small, dude. It's so tiny. We're a giant, giant country with this major class racial issue at the center of all of this.
I think one of the things that, and you really do debunk several myths in the book. One is about class size, and you say you could even argue that the real problem with advocating for smaller class size is that we've already done it.
Yeah, yes, we have. It was constantly, there's been a reduction in class size over the years since this became like a popular selling tool to get elected, right? And that kind of came because intuitively we all believe, and I believed, by the way, 100%, that the less kids in the class, the easier it'll be to teach. That's got to be a fact, a reality. Now, here's the thing. On this, it's a fascinating subject, actually, the classroom size subject, because it started kind of in 1985 with this study, this Tennessee Star study, which kind of has never been duplicated, and it showed big gains for reducing classroom size. Now, since then, there's been hundreds of studies on classroom size, and here's the bottom line, when you look at it in a meta way, is that it makes a small gain, very small. It cannot close the gap. This is not part of the instruments used to close the gap, because in addition to a concomitant issue with it from using it is you need more teachers. It costs a lot of money to add, you know, to reduce classes because you're adding it to other classes. You know, you're adding more classrooms, more teachers. It has such a drag on all the other things that do close the gap that it's not something to do. I don't believe in the health model. Like, for example, in the book, I always allude to the health model so people understand, because it makes it easier for me to understand how to keep it straight in your head. So, like, in the health model, if you do these five basic things, you sleep 8 hours a day, you eat a balanced diet, you exercise 3 times a week, you don't smoke, and you have a relatively low stress kind of work environment, you know, you keep some mental health, you know, at a certain level. Those five things, if you do those five things, almost all the chances of getting diseases drop to a very low rate, very, very, very low, astonishingly low, because the human body wants to be healthy, but you have to do them together. In the model here, classroom size wouldn't be one of those. Classroom size would be the equivalent of having a pet. And why I say that is because it's actually proven if you have a pet, you'll live a little bit longer. You'll have, and it makes sense, right? You're giving love and you're getting love back and things like that.
Right.
And so you get a little incremental boost from that. But that's not one of the five key things I would tell you to do to be healthy, right? It's not one of the triage things that you need to do to stay absolutely healthy. And in our case, that's what the thing is. It has very little effect and it has an enormous cost. So it's funny, at the end of the book, and this part's just my opinion, nothing in the book is my opinion. I put only facts from the research, but at the end I give a chapter and I said, if you were asking my opinion of how to pay for all the things that the research is saying to do, I would say do every one of the tenants and then add 2 kids to every classroom in the country, and you'll pay for everything. That's how costly it is to reduce class size, and you'll get no negative effect from putting the 2 extra kids in, and you'll close the gap with all the real things that you're doing.
Still to come, Joe Donahue's conversation with M. Night Shyamalan continues with a look at the future. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for The Best of Our Knowledge, number 1208. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is award-winning director M. Night Shyamalan, author of the new book, I Got Schooled, the unlikely story of how a moonlighting movie maker learned the five keys to closing America's education gap. He's speaking to The Best of Our Knowledge's Joe Donahue.
How hopeful are you that we're getting around to something that's going to work?
I'm very hopeful because, you know, you can always feel like a tipping point moment in a subject, whether it's, you know, people's awareness on global warming or whatever, or even let's talk about like the health thing like I just brought up. This is a tipping point moment as it gets the answer to your question. And I feel that, but who knows how long that tip will happen. It is tipping. I can feel it, and that's wonderful. I wouldn't have been able to write the book if I didn't have the last 5 years of people proving all the things in research. You know, the last 5 years is when it went from theory to proven, and I could put it in a book and say, it's proven. Here, this is what the principals do. This is the size of the school you need to have. This is how long the school name needs to be. And when I check it against the 50 schools that are closing the gap, they're doing all of them. They're doing all of them. So I have evidence that this can work. And I have evidence that it can work in small school systems, up to about 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 kids. Now, most of the school districts in the United States are around that. You can get to like 7 to 11,000. So we're right there about to prove that every school system of 11,000 kids, 7 to 11,000 kids, can close the gap with these techniques. So there's no longer this argument about scalability. It's about will. Now, this brings us back to the conversation about health. So, you know, I just had a conversation with a friend of mine who was talking about defending smoking. Now, you're not going to get many people defending smoking, but she was. And that tells you how long it takes for will to change, even with knowledge, right? So I don't know how long that conversation is, but I know the faster we get to knowledge, where everyone has the correct information, the will start to happen. You know, back, I guess, you know, when I don't know how old you are, but when we were kids, someone who worked out all the time, that they were like freaks, right? They were like weird. It was like right. Jack LaLanne. You were like, you're weird, dude. You work out, you're one of those freaks? And now you wouldn't buy an apartment. The first question you ask is, does it have a gym? It's primary to lifestyle now. It's normal. Everyone understands you need to exercise to be healthy. Eating a balanced diet. We all don't just go out and have Kentucky Fried Chicken every 5 seconds anymore. We go, oh, it's fried. We get a little, even if we eat it, we get a little pang of like, oh, it's bad for you. That knowledge takes a long time to turn into reality. And I don't know how long that'll take. I'm hoping it's very fast because this is about kids and it's really about our country. I think once we fix this, I believe that one of the great things holding the country back will go away.
So I'm 2 years older than you are, 45, and went to high school right outside of Philadelphia in the Wissahickon School District.
Whoa, did we play sports against each other?
Yeah, probably.
I remember you, dude.
I don't know that I played sports, but, you know, you mean metaphorically the team, sure. But you know, we had a great school. We also had great diversity, which I think was wonderful coming from that environment. And then I went back to the school just a couple months ago, and it's still pretty much the same in that regard, which I thought was really surprising after, you know, however many years it's been, 25, 27 years since I've graduated. So, right. but you think of change, and in that regard, I guess it really does move really slowly, doesn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's hard for, you know, a whole system to move, but there's people that are, because it's about kids, people are outraged and they're angry on both sides, which I think is a good thing because people are not going to stand for this much longer. I'm really excited about what 10 years from now would look like. Instead of 50 examples, will there be 700 examples, right, all around the country? And then it'll be so obvious that it can be done, and then it'll just become law. That's the hope.
Does it mature you talking about an issue like this and realizing suddenly, I don't know if you're anything like me, where you suddenly realize, oh my God, I'm a grown-up, that you that you say, okay, this will give a maturity to my work in the future?
Well, maybe, dude. I would love that. It's hard to, you know what it's helped me with? It's helped me understand when there's differences of opinion, when there's heatedness, the politics of it all is anchored in a misunderstanding. Like one of the things that I was really astonished to find is there's no bad guys. And I know that sounds crazy because everybody points to a bad guy in this field, but I didn't find that. I didn't find a group of people or a side that were coming from the wrong place and that were completely wrong. They each had a position. Like, for example, let's say, for example, you were staunchly in favor of protecting the teachers, right? They are correct that they have not been given the perfect environment. They have not been given a fair environment to succeed. They are 100% correct. They have not been given the support system, the environment, nothing. If you take a kid in June in the inner city who's going to public school and a kid in white suburbia, and in June, they're, let's just say hypothetically in second grade, they're at the same level, right? Just to say they came in and they're at the same level. In September, when they come back to school, the African-American or Hispanic inner-city kid has lost 3 months of learning, and the white suburban kid has gained 1 month of learning. So in September, when they look and they take the little test in September, they are 4 months apart. Now, to blame that on the teacher in the inner city is not fair because they're already now 3 months behind. That's nothing to do with the quality of their teaching, and so There's a lot to be said. You know, there are no villains here. It's all just about understanding the actual rules of this incredibly intricate and consistent system of education.
Again, the name of M. Night Shyamalan's new book is I Got Schooled, the unlikely story of how a moonlighting movie maker learned the five keys to closing America's education gap. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Joe Donahue. When you turn on the water in the kitchen sink, have you ever thought about the history of how that water got there? You will now. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. We have come to rely on the clean and inexpensive water that flows into our homes. But as John Broit, assistant professor of history at Case Western Reserve University, explains, there was a time when even the biggest municipal governments felt no responsibility for hydrating their citizens.
In 2005, the chairman and CEO of Nestle, Peter Brabeck, gave an interview in which he called the concept of a public right to a low-cost water supply an extreme one. Water, he said, should be sold like any other foodstuff by corporations like, well, Nestle. Every so often, the internet rediscovers this interview and outrage ensues. But he was right. The idea that local governments have a responsibility to provide their citizens plentiful, safe water is a radical one. It's just that we've forgotten it. When the idea surfaced in Britain and the U.S. around 150 years ago, people recognized it as extreme. There was a fierce debate about the appropriate role of the market in water supply, about the correct scope of government, and so on. My recent book rediscovers this debate. In most cities, the radical concept that governments do have an obligation to assure a safe, reliable water supply won out, from Birmingham to Liverpool to New York. And now we, especially in the U.S., take that expectation for granted. Well, most of us, not Nestle. My book focuses its attention on London because, paradoxically, the government of the capital of the avant-garde never took responsibility for providing its citizens with water. It tried at the end of the 1800s, but failed. There were those in Parliament who saw socialistic dangers in placing water supply in the hands of London's government, and they successfully took a stand against London. It is a right moment for rediscovering these old debates about whether the marketplace or public should assure a water supply. With clean water becoming ever more scarce and more valuable, it's a good bet we'll be forced to rehash the issue soon.
That was John Broit of Case Western Reserve University. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.